What's it like to have the nation's eyes upon you and international media grooming you? Not to mention delicate diplomatic relations hanging on your every word. Well, today we'll find out as Australia's most senior woman in government gets personal.
Feminism, by definition, is the belief that men and women should have equal rights and opportunities.
Feminism is about equality, isn't it? It's about men and women having the same opportunities in life.
If that does not suit you, then get out.
You know, there's been a lot of talk recently about whether our country is ready for women leaders.
It takes courage and strength to be empathetic.
Smashing the glass ceiling yet again.
Not now, not ever.
I moved on her like a bitch.
I just don't think there's a place for sexism in our politics.
Nobody respects women more than Donald Trump.
This has to stop.
Welcome to Broad Talk, the podcast about women, power and the wayward world. I'm Virginia Hausiger. As a broadcast journalist over the past few decades, I've interviewed hundreds of people across Australia and around the world. All sorts of people, from prime ministers to power moguls, CEOs to celebrities, villains to victors. But the one thing that's never stopped fascinating me is leadership. What is it that makes some people in a crowd stand out and step up? Well, that's what we're going to explore in the first series of Broad Talk. We'll take a deep dive into new leadership. I want to know if we're moving towards a more feminised style of leadership, the sort of leadership that's emerged during the global coronavirus pandemic as a more successful and sustainable alternative to authoritarian strongman rule. We'll find out what sets these women apart from their male counterparts and take a look at the barriers that women face in leadership positions. In intimate discussions, I'll be asking some prominent leaders what they think about their own leadership style and how they smashed through some of their toughest challenges against all the odds. Like the sound of that? Well, then join me. Hit subscribe on whatever pod platform you're listening on and make sure you don't miss an episode. And while you're at it, connect with us on social media. We love to hear your thoughts, suggestions and comments. You can find us on Facebook at Broad Talk, all one word. Today we're taking a look at leadership in government, and we're doing it with, well, currently the most qualified woman in the country to talk on the subject. Senator Maurice Payne is perhaps one of our more elusive, if not intriguing, political leaders. As Australia's Minister for Foreign Affairs since 2018, she's avoided the personal media scrutiny her predecessor, Julie Bishop, received. And as Minister for Women, well, she's been particularly low-key. I wanted to hear more about who she really is, why she does what she does, and what she thinks about the role and responsibility of women in leadership. Maurice, welcome to Broad Talk. Thank you so much for giving us the time, particularly at such a busy time for you.
Thanks, Virginia. Looking forward to it.
You've just recently given a very powerful speech at ANU, at the Security College, which got a lot of media coverage. And I just want to start off by asking you, not about that speech in which you really laid down the law, but what it's like afterwards. So you give a powerful speech, a big, strong message to our foreign community, with messages to Russia, to the US. When it's over, you go home, what's it like? Do you just sort of sit for a moment and think about, you know, gosh, the fallout will start any moment, if it hasn't already? Or do you go to bed and have a good night's sleep? What's it like for you?
I think that's an interesting question because at the moment there is so much going on. And in a circumstance like that, sometimes I have to come back to Parliament and do some media, which is what happened in this context. So the issues keep rolling for a while, a couple of interviews in that context. Ultimately, once you get home, of course, in Canberra, it's not home. So it's wherever you happen to stay, however you share, have whatever shared arrangements you have. I share a house with four other parliamentary colleagues. That can be fabulous and occasionally challenging.
Annoying.
never annoying, but occasionally challenging. And in this context, you know, it's a chance to just chat about something else for a little bit. And I think on the occasion of this speech, it involved reheating some takeaway and sharing that with a couple of my housemates and talking about something else. But the one thing I always do at the end of the day when I'm in Canberra, as often as I possibly can, is to compare notes with my partner, Stuart, who, as many would know, is also a parliamentarian, also a minister. Mm. And between us, we can have some pretty strange days. So it is always good to compare notes and ground ourselves in the things that we do together, which at the moment include building a new home. So that keeps me pretty focused.
No doubt it's lovely, though, to have something quite outside politics, and also because he's a parliamentarian outside of federal politics, it's something that you can shift your attention to, which is nice.
It's very nice. Absolutely it is. And we have very, very different roles, although similar jobs in some way, and the differences between our roles mean talking about the others is a refreshing change from what we've been doing all day. But the things that we do outside are important to us.
Maurice, you're the highest ranking woman in federal politics in Australia right now. And as such, really, you're Australia's most prominent female national leader. Is that at times a lonely place?
I don't think it's lonely as such. I think it is something which a position I'm extraordinarily honoured to hold, and I must say it does come on the back of a long, long parliamentary career. And I think loneliness, not so much. The environment here in Canberra is it changes. It's quite dynamic, but at the moment, I work very closely with a range of my friends and colleagues, with all of my cabinet colleagues. We are in very regular contact. And what's interesting about that is the way that the speed of communication and the facility of communication has changed that. If I think back to my friends who were cabinet ministers in the Howard government, you know, they wouldn't have been in WhatsApp groups, self-evidently. They wouldn't have been able to constantly communicate with each other or compare notes or ask a question without a much more formalised process of, you know, getting your staff to find out if someone's free and whether you can give them a quick call or trying to give them a quick call. That change, I know that makes me sound ancient, but that change has been...
Don't worry, I'm really just as ancient. But look, I wonder though, you know, and I won't go on too much about this, but doesn't it sometimes feel as if there's too much coming at you because of that incredible accessibility and contact that we now have through technology?
Sometimes, most certainly. Absolutely. You can find yourself, you know, trying to choose which particular mandarin you might want to buy in the greengrocers, six WhatsApps come at you between one box of mandarins and the next, and you think, this can't be happening. Yeah. But it is.
So in a nutshell, though, how do you switch off from all of that? And do you? I mean, do you actually sometimes just put the phone down and say, right, I'm vegging out for 15 minutes or half an hour?
I don't often have the chance to put the phone down, to be absolutely frank. It doesn't really work that way. It didn't work that way as defence minister, doesn't work that way as foreign minister, and I don't have that expectation really. But in terms of switching off, as I said, in my family, we try really hard to do that. We try to preserve time that is our time. There are a couple of things that that we share a passion for. Sport is one, and when our teams are playing each other, don't get in the way. Horse racing, interestingly, is another. As I said, we're building a new home. Those sorts of things are really good mechanisms for switching off, and we both have very special families as well.
What to get a bit of a sense of your backstory. I know that you entered politics at a very young age. You joined the Liberal Party in 1982, when I think you're probably about 18 or so. But I'm wondering if leadership as such was in your DNA, because you have had a very strong career as a leader. You were the national president of Young Liberals by the time you were in your mid-20s, and you took on a number of leadership roles. But I want to ask you about that with reference to a few other global leaders, one of them being Sam Power, the former US ambassador to the UN. And I raise this because she was here yesterday. She was here last year and spoke at ANU. And I thought it was fascinating the way she talked about her background, which had no indication that she would ever end up doing what she did. She was an Irish immigrant. Her father was a hopeless alcoholic. She brought up by a single mum. And people like Madeleine Albright also says she was the most unlikely leader. And in fact, she goes on to say in her memoir, I was never supposed to be what I became. Were you supposed to become a political leader in the way you have?
I'm not quite sure about that. I think I come from a family which has always valued the importance of public service, however that manifests. My father was a World War II soldier, volunteer, who signed up to go to the Pacific. And that played a very important role in his attitude to life and the attitude that he inculcated, conveyed to his children, both my brother and to me. So that concept has always been a very important part of my life. I suspect that if joining the Australian Defence Force had been an option for me as a lawyer, if I'd known it was an option for me, then that may ultimately have been a path I took. But I didn't know in the 1980s that you could do that. That wasn't particularly
well. There weren't many women doing it. There weren't many examples. I don't think you've got to see it to believe it.
That's true. And I don't think it was particularly gendered at the time. It just didn't occur to me. The ADF never came to my girls' school in Sydney, and never. I always wanted to be a lawyer. I thought. So I did study law, and I joined the Liberal Party at an early age. My family were very, very strong Liberal voters, and so that was part of growing up as well. And the concept of current affairs, I think, bizarrely, maybe one of my favourite subjects towards the end of my school life was general studies. It was nobody else's favourite subject, but I loved
it. Was mine too, can I say, Maurice? It was mine.
I loved
too.
Current affairs, and I loved the opportunity to talk about those things and English and French and so on. But I think my father passed away before I entered the Senate. He was certainly still well alive when I was active in Young Liberal and Liberal Party politics, and I think he was proud of that. In fact, I'm sure he was. My mother has also passed away, but she saw me elected to the Parliament. And I think she would say it was a path she saw me taking. I didn't become a practicing lawyer for a range of reasons, one of which was just a circumstance of a very bad car accident while I was at university, which made me rethink life and rethink life to the extent of saying you should do what you want to do now because sometimes there's no tomorrow.
And I know that very well myself, and it does certainly push you forward. But did you actually see yourself as a leader? And I'm thinking about, in your 20s, in mid-20s, for example, to take on a national president role of a political body is a really big thing to do. So there must have been something within you that made you think, yeah, I can do that. I should do that. I'm tough enough, strong enough to do that. Is that how you sort of grappled with it, or did you not grapple at all? It was just an obvious thing for you.
I don't think I did grapple with it. I don't think it was an issue of that nature. It was an obvious thing for me to do at the time, having gone through the ranks in the New South Wales Liberal Party, which is a fierce training school, and achieved a couple of things there. It was an obvious thing for me to do, and I really enjoyed the opportunity to take on that role. The Liberal Party, federally at least, was in a very different position then than it is now, and certainly politics is all about peaks and troughs and the will of the people. But it was challenging to choose that that path. I think some of my lecturers at university used to look at me and wonder what on earth they had in front of them. But they coped and I coped, and the rest is history, as they say.
Maurice, you've clearly followed your heart at times. I thought it was really interesting to learn that you were actually vice president of the Australian Republican Movement. And at the time, you were also an advisor to the Liberal Premier, John Fay. I thought it was interesting to read just recently that Tony Abbott was very critical of you taking up that role with the Australian Republican Movement, and actually went as far as saying anyone who doesn't support constitutional monarchy is at odds with the party. In other words, you know, you don't fit with this party or you're a traitor. Now, he went on to become Prime Minister and you went on to serve as a minister under him. Now, how do you win back someone? How do you win them over when they've already questioned, publicly indeed, questioned your fundamental values and your beliefs?
Well, Tony wasn't the only person who did that. That was an issue of great debate in the Liberal Party in particular. And yes, I did become deputy chair of the Australian Republican Movement under the leadership of Malcolm Turnbull. So there's lots of links and engagements there. I think if you can show that you can do a good job, and you can show that you are capable and competent, and also able to prosecute a case without reducing it to invective or emotion or conflict, then you can prove that you're capable. And so I was very grateful to be asked by Tony Abbott to serve in his first ministry in 2013 as the Minister for Human Services. I must admit, at the time, I thought that was a very big job. Human Services is the second largest employer in the Commonwealth with over 30,000 staff. There were 350 or 400 physical locations around Australia. It was a department of its own in the outer ministry. So it was a huge task. I was then particularly honoured to be asked by Malcolm Turnbull to become defence minister. And if I needed to learn about big jobs, that was a good way to do it.
Indeed. But I'm wondering, with reference back to the role that you played with the Australian Republican Movement and the disappointment, no doubt, when Australia voted not to become a republic, when you do then get into even more senior roles or significant roles of power, positions of power, I should say, what do you do with those really heartfelt ambitions? Do you have to just shelve some of them? And I mean, as I said, you are now indeed the most powerful and highest ranked woman in Australia. You could make that an issue if you wanted to, but you've clearly shelved it. Do you have to do that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things about that. I'm not sure that I've shelved it. I suspect the Australian discourse on the matter has shifted considerably. I haven't changed my views, not one iota. And I don't intend to, but I do think the Australian discourse has shifted. I'm a financial paid up member of the Australian Republican Movement. I hope, as long as I've paid my dues, I watch with interest their activities. For me, it's probably more a function of time than anything else, and the broad range of other things that I have on my plate. I'm not sure if it's in my Twitter profile, but it's certainly on everything that I fill in. When I fill in memberships, I always add the Australian Republican Movement. When the debate and the discourse comes around again in Australia, then I think you can expect that I'd be part of that conversation.
Okay. I want to talk also now about women and leadership. And given that our series here on Broad Talk is specifically on leadership and new leadership, I was very surprised to learn that you actually call yourself a feminist. And I say that because Several of the past ministers for women in your government have not called themselves feminists, in fact refused to, and of course when the Prime Minister Tony Abbott was Minister for Women, he certainly didn't call himself a feminist. Why do you feel the need to give yourself that identity?
I'm not sure, Virginia, it's about feeling the need to give myself that identity. For me, it's just a fact. I think Rebecca West...
What does it mean? What does it mean to you when you say it's
a fact? I was just going to say, I think Rebecca West, if I can paraphrase this, because I don't have the direct quote in front of me, I think she once said, people call me a feminist. This has to be listened to or considered in context of the time. People call me a feminist when I express sentiments that differentiate me from a doormat. In the time, and some of us, of course, have been watching Mrs. America in isolation and watching that superb performance by Kate Blanchett and Rose Byrne. They are just superlative, both of them in those roles. Mm. And I found that fascinating.
Does it fire up your sense of feminism watching that, by the way?
Well, yes, probably in some ways. But, you know, I know plenty of men who call themselves feminists as well. And for them, it's about making sure that gender equality is in our DNA. And so I don't think you have to have labels. There's lots of labels I wouldn't ascribe to. I want to get on with my job of pursuing gender equality in Australia, of pursuing gender equality in politics, and pursuing gender equality for women particularly who simply are not in a position to advocate or do that for themselves. And I do think the roles that we as parliamentarians hold put us in a position of great privilege and responsibility to do that. Sometimes I listen to women involved in politics, and Mrs. America has kind of reminded me of this. Mm. Sometimes I listen to women in politics who say that this is not a focus that is necessary. And I think that if you're elected to Parliament, paid a considerable salary to serve the Australian people, probably come to the Parliament with a very good education and opportunities to have made a contribution in life, then it's somewhat relatively easier to say that. But if you are a woman who's in a marginalised position, if you are a woman who deals with some of the most vexed challenges in life every day, whether it is a lack of education or poverty or violence or discrimination or disability or whatever it might be, then it's not that easy to say we don't need to do this. And so we have a role, and people who want to serve in this context, and everyone will choose their different method of service, by the way. I'm not prescriptive at all. But we have a role in making sure that we are able to advocate and engage for women in those situations.
Maurice, I'm going to ask you a tough one on this because the conversation is steered towards this, and I don't want to get into policy discussions with you, but I sometimes wonder, given what you've just said, I wonder if it hurts that you, as Minister for Women, and as I say, the highest ranking woman in Australia, if you, when you know that you can't do as much as you should do and that you're not doing enough for women and for gender equality, and I don't mean that personally, but I mean just from in terms of what the government's prepared to deliver and what you're able to get through. You know, there has been, of course, disquiet, there always is, that not enough is being done to progress gender equality in this country. Does that hurt you? That you can't quite push everything through?
I don't think that hurt is the word that I would use. I think what politics teaches you is that it is about working across a team, working across every portfolio area, every policy area in a government. And although I understand what you're saying, I appreciate the import of your question, there's probably not a ministerial responsibility in a Commonwealth government that can say they are doing and are able to do everything that they want to do to deliver for their particular portfolio area. So whether it's young people, whether it's aged people, whether it's people in rural and regional Australia, government is about a team. It's about networks and systems and management and, to greater and lesser degrees, from time to time, compromise. And governments have to work within certain constructs. Now, in an ideal world, we would all do everything we wanted to do for every single person that we could. But it doesn't actually work that way in reality. And one thing two decades in politics has taught me, is that that is the reality. And you have to learn how to work within that to maximise what you are able to deliver.
So the message I'm getting from this, and look, correct me if I'm getting it wrong, but the message I'm getting in terms of what this says about leadership, and there is, you know, there's no doubt that you have been an extraordinary leader throughout your career, is that you have to be pragmatic and you have to be fairly hard-headed about that pragmatism. Is that right?
Pragmatic and hard-headed. Broadly, yes. And I think that goes for anyone who is involved in the political process and in leadership. Virginia, I think in terms of pragmatism or hard-headedness, I know that you're very engaged there with the University of Canberra, and I presume the leadership of a university has to be pragmatic and hard-headed in the way they approach doing their business. If you're running a corporation, then you have to be pragmatic and hard-headed. I think it doesn't really matter where it lands. If you're idealistic and that's what you want to be, then I think probably you're more of an advocate than a manager, and that's a different role. And there are hundreds of amazing men and women, overwhelmingly in some of the areas in which I work, women who are incredibly idealistic, committed, passionate, wonderful advocates. I am a passionate, committed, pragmatic and hard-headed minister.
Okay, I get it. I want to take you back to 2018. You weren't the Minister for Women then. It was and right back to when the former Prime Minister was heading the table, Malcolm Turnbull. 2018 was a really tough year for your government in terms of women in politics. And there was almost, we got to a point where there wasn't a day where there wasn't a media headline about the Liberal Party's women problem or woman problem, allegations of sexism, allegations of bullying, some of your colleagues speaking out, then withdrawing. We also had the very dramatic quitting from Julia Banks, who quit the party and quite famously thrashed out or lashed out at party members in her final speech about bullying, gender abuse, etc. What was that like for you? You weren't outspoken at the time, and I'm not aware of you saying anything in particular in defence of your colleagues, those who spoke out. What was that time like for you?
I think for anyone who is a long-term committed member of a political party, seeing it engaged in any sort of trauma and difficulty such as the ones that you've asked me about is very difficult. And you outed me very early in this conversation as somebody who joined the Liberal Party in 1982. I don't think I'd cracked 18. I think I might have still been 17 at the actual time. And the trauma of that, no matter how it manifests, I think is very significant for all of us. And that's happened for me a few times over my political and parliamentary career. And, of course, we see that playing out right now in Australia in terms of what has been discussed in relation to the Victorian Labor Party. This is hard. It's really hard for committed party members who work for a cause, and who are passionate and committed and responsible and only want to see their party in a position of delivering good government to their state or their nation. It's really hard for party members to see that sort of trauma. It is perhaps even more difficult when it is so gendered as it was at that time in 2018. And I know I spoke to some of your journalist colleagues in a number of interviews, probably in my other roles, whether it was as defence minister or as foreign minister, and did answer some questions on these issues at the time. It's really difficult. Now, we've come a long way since that, and I think it's also important to understand when conflict within a political party develops in the way that it did then, perhaps in the way it's doing in the Victorian Labor Party at the moment, when conflict develops, then it's never going to be about one thing. Never going to be about one thing.
When you say it's really hard, which clearly it is, at what point, though, is the obligation on you as a powerful leading female in politics and one who calls herself a feminist, at what point is the obligation to step in, speak up, make demands, at what point does that obligation not occur?
Well, I think you're making some assumptions there, Virginia, about what occurred in 2018 and how people handle things. It's not in my style and has never been to take those sorts of things to, you know, the second floor of Parliament House and deal with them there. I have always worked with my colleagues as far as possible. As far as possible. There are probably some exceptions that people will refer to over a 23-so-far-year career in this place, but I've always tried to work within the system and with my colleagues, leaders, counterparts, ministerial colleagues, to resolve issues. And there were hours and hours and hours of discussions amongst colleagues here, amongst leaders here, amongst ministers here, and amongst the party organisation leaders as well about these issues. So I think that addressing them is obviously important. There's no question about that. I want women in Australia, particularly young women in Australia, to think that joining a political party and I wouldn't say I was agnostic about which party they joined by any means, but participation in the political process, more young women who see politics as a potential career, be it Liberal or National or Labor or Green or whatever it might be, that is a fabulous thing. So we have to be our best possible role model and the best possible person and the best possible system to show that it is a job worth doing. So I'm a big advocate for that. But there are ways to address problems, and I worked very hard with colleagues at that time. And some of those colleagues have since left the parliament. I know they were also very important in that process. And I think about my friend Kelly O'Dwyer and others who've been great contributors over the years.
You and I could talk about this for hours, and I'm very tempted to, but I want to move it on because I want to get on to the issue of women and leadership style during the COVID pandemic. But we're going to take a short break for a moment. Now, if you're enjoying this episode of Broad Talk, and I'm pleased that you're listening to Minister Maurice Payne, who is not only our Minister for Women in Australia, but also our Foreign Minister, Foreign Affairs Minister. We'll be back in just a moment.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Broad Talk with me, Virginia Hausiger, and Maurice Payne. Senator Maurice Payne is the Minister for Women and Foreign Minister here in Australia, and as such, she is the highest ranking woman in Australia, and many would say therefore the most powerful. We've been having a very wide-ranging chat about her background, women and leadership. But Maurice, I want to go straight now to women and leadership style during the COVID pandemic, the crisis. There's no doubt that this extraordinary crisis has also highlighted what perhaps you and I knew very well, which is that women manage crises very well indeed. But it's interesting to see there have been global media headlines going quite bananas over women leaders, as if this is a brand new discovery. And you know, from one end of the globe to the other, news media has been applauding the success of women leaders. Seven or eight nations in particular highlighting New Zealand and Jacinda Ardern, highlighting the work done in Germany, in Norway, in Finland, Iceland, Taiwan, Denmark, all nations that have done very well in handling the pandemic. Do you think that the COVID pandemic's given rise to an understanding of a new style of leadership that we're now seeing around the globe? And if you do, how would you characterise that?
I think that's an interesting question to ask here in Australia. I mean, self-evidently, the Prime Minister and his leadership here, and particularly his institution of the National Cabinet with the leaders of the states and territories, including, of course, two female premiers, Gladys Berejiklian and Premier Palaszczuk. That has been a leadership that has worked particularly well. And I have to say that because I've been part of that and working within that. In terms of the style of leadership that we might be seeing from some of the countries that you've mentioned, could it be that this is as fundamental as sound, good decision making? Maybe we're even back to your questions earlier about pragmatic approaches to problem solving. And the countries that you've suggested there, and I'd include Australia in that, have taken good decision making to a new height in terms of what they've been able to achieve. So I think whether that is gendered and reflected in that very practical and pragmatic approach, perhaps history will make those assessments in some ways.
But there's a statistical issue there as well, though, isn't there, Maurice? I mean, we only have, out of 193 nations, member states of the UN, 180 of them are led by men, so there's only 13 led by women, and at least eight of them are doing better than the rest of the world in their handling of the crisis. So on stats alone, it looks like women are doing much better. There's got to be a gendered aspect to that, doesn't there?
Well, they're good figures, there's no doubt, and I think it is important to point that out. And yes, they're doing a very good job. Now, gendered, you know, they've risen to be the leaders of their countries for a good reason. Because they're good leaders, I presume, elected by their peers to either lead their political party or their nation, but most likely both, depending on each system. So they're good leaders to start with. And I think that's really important, that where those 13 countries, as you say, led by women, eight of them are beating the statistics, where they are doing that, they are actually delivering in spades for young women in their countries, looking at them, looking for role models and looking for perhaps even career paths. I think that's fabulous. And I deal with a number of them, as you can imagine. In Norway, for example, one of the countries that you referred to, the foreign minister in Norway, Ina Eriksen Søreide, and I have been friends for a long time. We were defence ministers together. Now we're foreign ministers together. And there are warm relationships across so many of these countries. That is something which I have found particularly interesting through COVID. I've met countless times with women foreign ministers and also with ministers for women in so many countries in a way that did not occur before we were trying to deal with a pandemic. And it is continuing.
So, sorry, you mean the women leaders have rallied together in a way they haven't before?
Yes. And the opportunity has been presented because, in many ways, our jobs, our roles, and the way we're able to do them at the moment have changed. And they have come together in a way that has not been the case before. So the female foreign ministers, for example, and I've participated now a couple of times, have traditionally met around UNGA Week in New York in one way and another. But that has been, other than bilateral engagements, that's been the most substantial engagement. There are now many more calls and video conferences, WebExes, Zooms, whatever they might be. I had a fabulous opportunity just a couple of weeks ago to co-convene with the Deputy Prime Minister of Samoa, who is a fabulous Samoan woman leader, Fiame Naomi Mataafa. I had a chance to convene with her a meeting of 31 Pacific women leaders from parliaments and from civil service. Amazing to have the opportunity to bring that together. Now, would we have physically been able to do that in the way that we did? I'm not sure necessarily that it would have been that simple to do. But what we have resolved to do out of that in the Pacific is to make sure we are going to launch in-person meetings and encourage this with continuity in real time, face to face. So huge opportunities, ironically, growing out of crisis.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because that is happening also beyond politics, but in research, academic, advocate, and activist circles as well, and women's circles. The same thing, I've got to say, has happened in that we are coming together and networking, and again via Zoom and those sorts of devices in a way that we haven't before, looking at the impact of this on women and what we need to do and how we need to respond and what we need to be suggesting to government in a really energetic way that I haven't seen for decades. It's extraordinary, isn't it? And I'm just wondering, you know, this is going to sound a bit highfalutin, but is it possible that this is sort of giving rise to potentially a whole new way of women's, not necessarily activism, but women's work or highlighting the value of women's input?
I think so. I hope so. And I'd like to be part of ensuring that that is the case. I know the opportunities that we have identified here, and you're right, others in different walks of life have identified this for me as well as an interesting step change in how we are able to work together. I do think that if we can preserve that, it would be a really valuable takeout from what has been an extraordinarily difficult time.
How do we do that? How do we preserve it?
Just keep doing it. I mean, just keep doing it. We must continue to schedule and to engage. I mean, I know there are plenty of opportunities that are going to be ahead of us in terms of face-to-face, person-to-person meetings, but the facilitation of multi-layered engagements of multiple players in a way that has been so hard to do before, we just have to keep doing it. And I think that will take determination, no question, and it will take some focus and planning. But what a great, great opportunity to continue it.
You joined with a huge collection of women ministers around the world to to jointly sign a very, very powerful letter, and then wrote an op-ed about it, which was published in The Strategist here in Australia, in which you are calling on governments to respond better to the needs of women as a result of the pandemic. And you went as far as saying governments and the UN must show leadership. The world's decision makers have an opportunity to make gender equality a top priority. We urge them to rise to the occasion. It was very powerful. Why is it that that call hasn't been heeded?
I think that we are still, in so many places, Virginia, we are still absolutely mid-crisis. Now, as we watch the statistics of COVID impact out of parts of South Asia, parts of Africa, out of parts of Latin America, South America, they are very much still struggling with the most up-close and challenging aspects of a pandemic. And what we need to make sure we are doing is continuing the views that were put in that that op-ed that you've talked about. We need to make sure they are part of all of our discussions, and that is certainly the case here when I'm working with my counterparts across the ministry, when the Office of Women is working with various agencies across the Commonwealth government, making sure that we are talking about the importance of gender equality. So we had been, before the pandemic, we had been at a point where, from an Australian perspective, for example, we had the highest level of women's workforce participation that we had ever seen in Australia. Now, there is no question that the economic impact of the pandemic is going to affect that. No question whatsoever. But our target, our goal, our challenge is to return to that point and then to increase it. Same with the narrowing of the gender pay gap. Same with the fact that we'd met our G20 commitment to reduce that gap in women's workforce participation by 25% by 2025. We met that in January 2020. So these challenges are ones which we identify and we know we have to address. They're core business for me.
What about the international big, big challenge, though, that you have been outspoken on, and it's a really, really difficult one, which, of course, is the provision of sexual and reproductive health services? We know that the US has really clamped down very hard on this. And again, I go back to that extraordinary letter that you and women around the world signed, is calling for better response to that and for lifting of bans of supporting sexual and reproductive health services. Are you making any traction on that?
Well, we do think that this is important, and it has been part of Australia's approach across our development program for many years. Countries will make their own decisions. The United States has most certainly enunciated its concerns. So have other countries, but Australia will
continue. But does it make you cross what the United States has done?
No, I don't think it makes me cross. It makes me more focused on what we need to do and how we need to engage, and how we need to continue to articulate why it is so important for women and for families to be able to look after their health, their sexual and reproductive health in this context. Absolutely fundamental in terms of their rights. So we will continue to put Australia's case, and we'll continue to work with like-minded counterparts around the world, and there are many who have this as a priority in their development programs. And for those who choose not to, I've spoken recently about focusing on Australia's national interests. Well, they are countries that focus on their national interests, and while I'll continue my advocacy, they will, of course, make their own decisions.
Maurice, you've been incredibly generous, and we appreciate very, very much the time that you have given us. It's been a fascinating discussion, and we could go on for another hour. Maybe we will some other time, but I want to thank you very much for your the time that you have given us today, and also the honesty that you've shared. So thank you for joining Broad Talk.
Thank you, Virginia. I've really enjoyed the opportunity, and best wishes with Broad Talk, and best wishes with the work that you do, particularly in your advocacy and your campaigning. It's fabulous to see.
Oh, thank you very much. I really, really appreciate that coming from you. All the very best.
Thank you.
That was Senator Maurice Payne, Minister for Women and Foreign Affairs in the Australian Government. Now, dear listener, if you've stuck with us this far, what did you think? If you'd like to share your thoughts about our discussion or some of the issues raised, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Virginia_House, H-A-U-S-S, or join our chat group on Facebook and pull up a seat at the Broad Talk Roundtable at facebook.com/groups/broadtalk, all one word. Or just send me an email, virginia@virginiahousiger.com.au. Join me again next week for episode 2 in our series on new leadership, when I'll be chatting with Dame Annette King. She's New Zealand's longest-serving female MP and currently serving as the High Commissioner to Australia. Until then, Broadies, let's keep talking. Happy chat.